You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Light Course, given to the newly formed Waldorf School teachers in Stuttgart. This is given in Stuttgart on December 29th, 1919. Today I would like to continue my examination for you of the principal ideas that we began with the day before yesterday. If we start out from the knowledge we have gained with light, we will be able to observe and understand further the phenomena that can be revealed in the other natural phenomena we still want to study. So today I will concentrate on the principles and postpone the experimental work until tomorrow, since we still have to figure out just what methods we want to use. It's really a matter of precisely following through to their conclusion what is present in the natural phenomena, and light gives us the most clues for pursuing that course. Historically, it so happened that people began to study light phenomena relatively late. In general, the whole way of thinking about physical phenomena, as it is done in our schools today, hardly goes back further than the 16th century. Before the 16th century, the way of thinking about physical phenomena was radically different. Today, however, this way of thinking has been taken up so strongly in school that it becomes extraordinarily difficult for anyone who has gone through a certain kind of schooling in physics to return to the purely factual. First, you have to get used to feeling. Please don't take the expression merely in its trivial sense. To experiencing the purely factual. You actually have to get used to it. For that reason, I want to start out with a specific case, comparing the customary didactic way of thinking with what we can actually gain through a proper pursuit of the facts. See Figure 6A. Let's assume that you have the cross section of a plate of glass here. Through this plate of glass, you see a shining object. I will sketch the thing, but instead of the shining object, let's say simply I draw a shining circle here. And again, figure 6A. Now imagine yourself back on the school bench once more and recall what you actually learned from this vantage point about visual observation. You were told that rays emanated from this shining object. We're interested in a certain line of sight for the eye, EYE. In other words, in the direction of this ray, the light penetrates, as they say, from a thinner medium into a denser medium. If we simply look through the plate of glass and compare what happens with what is really there, we can perceive that the shining object is displaced and appears at a different spot than when we look at it without the plate of glass. This is said to stem from the fact that the light is bent. That's what they say when the light enters a denser medium from a thinner medium. Then, in order to figure out the direction, we have to draw a so-called angle of incidence. If the light continued on its way without being hindered by a denser medium of this kind, it would go in this direction. However, the light is bent, as they say, and in fact it is bent toward this perpendicular of incidence, toward this perpendicular line that we drop at the point of incidence. On the other hand, if you follow how we look at the ray through the denser medium, we have to set up a perpendicular of incidence where it exits as well. At this point, the ray, if it were to continue on its path, would go this way, but it is bent once again, in this case away from the perpendicular of incidence. In fact, and just strongly enough, that its direction is now parallel to its former one. When the eye sees that, it lengthens the last direction for itself and shifts the shining object a certain distance higher up. Thus, if we look through like this, we have to assume that the light falls here and is bent twice, once toward the perpendicular of incidence, and once away from the perpendicular of incidence. Because the eye has this inner ability, parenthesis, or a soul, or some demon, however you want to say it, close parenthesis, the light is shifted in space, in fact, to another spot in space, than where it would appear if we didn't see it through a refractive medium, as they call it. However, it is important to keep the following in mind. You see, if we look through the same denser medium and try to make a slight distinction between, say, a brighter spot and a somewhat darker spot, we find that not just this brighter part is displaced upward, but the somewhat darker part is as well. See figure 6b. We will see the whole complex, you see, here displaced upward. I would like you to take that into consideration. Here we see a darker area bordered by a brighter one. We see the darker area displaced upward. And because it has one brighter end, we see that displaced upward too. So, if you put up a complex of this kind, a darker area and a brighter area, you have to say that the brighter part is displaced simply as the upper border. If you abstract a bright spot, then people often speak as if only this bright spot were displaced. But that's an absurdity. For even if I look at this bright spot here, it is not true that it is the only thing that is displaced. Instead, in reality, this area down here, which I'll call nothingness, is also displaced upward. Whatever is displaced is never something I can delimit so abstractly. Thus, if I do the experiment that Newton did, if I let in a beam of light, which is diverted by the prism, then it isn't true that only the beam of light is displaced. What borders the beam of light above and below is displaced too. I should never speak of any sort of rays of light or the like, but of displaced light images or light spaces. And if somewhere I do want to talk about an isolated light, then I can't talk about it at all in a way that relates this isolated light to something in the theory. Rather, I have to talk about it in such a way that my words refer simultaneously to what borders it. Only if we think in this way can we really feel what is actually happening when we are faced with the origin of color phenomena. Otherwise, simply because of our way of thinking, we get the impression that the colors somehow arise from light. We have already worked out the thought that we are dealing only with light. In reality, we aren't dealing with light, but with something bright, which is bordered on one side or the other by darkness. And just as this bright area is displaced as light space, the dark area is displaced in the same way. But what is this dark area? What is it actually? You see, this dark area also has to be grasped as something absolutely real. Everything that has come into modern physics since approximately the 16th century was able to come in only because we never observed things with the spirit. We observed things only on the basis of outward sense impressions and then invented all sorts of theories to explain these external sense impressions. You won't be able to deny in any way that if you look at light, sometimes it's stronger and other times it's weaker. Stronger and weaker light do exist. It's a matter of understanding how this light, which can be stronger or weaker, is related to the darkness. The ordinary physicist of today thinks there is stronger and weaker light, every possible degree of light in terms of strength, but only one single darkness, which is simply there when light isn't there. Thus, there is only one kind of black. There is no more just one kind of darkness, then there is just one kind of brightness. To say that there is only one kind of darkness is as one-sided as if you were to say, I know four people. One has assets of 500 marks, and the second assets of 1,000 marks. In other words, one has greater assets than the other does. The third, however, has a debt, of 500 marks, and the fourth a debt of 1,000 marks. But why should I worry any more about this difference? In the end, it's the same thing. Both have debts. I want to distinguish between degrees of wealth, but I don't want to distinguish at all between degrees of debt, because debt is debt. Close quote. In this case, the matter attracts our attention because the effect of 500 marks of debt is less than the effect of 1,000 marks of debt. With darkness, we don't act this way. Light has different degrees of brightness. Darkness is darkness. The fact that we haven't progressed to a qualitative way of thinking is what hinders us so much in finding the bridge between the soul-spirit realm on the one hand and the physical on the other. When a space is filled with light, it is filled with light of a certain strength. When a space is filled with darkness, it is filled with darkness of a certain strength. We have to progress from merely abstract space to space that is not abstract, but that is in some way positively filled with light, negatively filled with darkness. Thus we can face the light-filled space and can call it qualitatively positive. We can face the space filled with darkness and find it qualitatively negative with reference to the light. Both, however, can be addressed in terms of a particular degree of intensity, a particular strength. Now, however, you wonder, quote, yes, but how does this positive state of light-filled space distinguish itself for our powers of perception from the negative state of filled-up space? Close quote. For this positive state of filled-up space, we need only to recall how it is when we wake up, surrounded by light, and unite our subjective experience with what floods around us as light. We need only to compare this feeling with what we feel when we are surrounded by darkness. And we will find that, I'd like you to understand this very precisely, for our feelings, there is a difference between abandoning ourselves to light-filled space and abandoning ourselves to space that is filled with darkness. We can approach these things only by comparison. You see, we can compare that feeling we have when we encounter the light-filled space to a kind of breathing in of the light by our soul nature. Indeed, we feel enriched when we are in a light-filled space. We breathe the light in. What is it like with darkness? That feeling is the complete opposite. Darkness drains us. It soaks us up. We have to abandon ourselves to it. We have to give up something to it. Thus we can say that light has an imparting effect on us, and darkness has a draining effect on us. And we have to distinguish between bright and dark colors in this way too. The brighter colors have something that comes toward us, that imparts itself to us. The dark colors have something that drains us, that we must give ourselves up to. Then we come to the point where we say to ourselves that something in the outer world is imparting itself to us when light acts upon us, and that something is taken away from us, drawn out of us, when darkness acts upon us. As I've already pointed out to you in these lectures, our consciousness is in a certain respect drained away when we fall asleep. Consciousness ceases at that moment, when we approach the darker colors, blue and violet, from the brighter ones. There is a very similar phenomenon of the cessation of consciousness. And if you'll recall what I told you recently about the relationship of our soul nature to mass, the falling asleep into mass, the draining away of consciousness by mass, then you will feel something similar in the draining away of consciousness by darkness. You will discover the inner relationship between the darkness that can fill space and that other way in which space can be filled, which we call matter, and which manifests itself as mass. In other words, we have to search for the path leading from the phenomena of light across to the phenomena of material existence. And we have already blazed the path for ourselves by searching out the fleeting phenomena, as it were, of phosphorescence and fluorescence, and then the stable light phenomena. In the case of the stable light phenomena, we have permanent colors. We can't look at these things individually. First, we will want to describe the whole complex of things. Now, it's a matter of understanding the following. If you are in light-filled space, you merge with this light-filled space in a certain way. We can say that something in us floats out into this light-filled space and merges with it. However, you have only to reflect a little bit on the facts to discover a big difference between this oneness with the immediate light-flooded surroundings and the sort of oneness that we have as human beings with, for example, the temperature of the surroundings. We take part in the conditions of warmth of our surroundings. We take part in it by feeling something like a polarity of the temperature, warmth and cold. However, we can't avoid perceiving a difference between our feeling of self in the surrounding conditions of warmth and our feeling of self in the surrounding conditions of light. Not only has this distinction been lost to modern physics since the 16th century, but we have also striven to blur any differences of this kind. Anyone who really looks at this difference between living through the conditions of warmth and living through the conditions of light, which in the real world is simply a given, can't avoid making the distinction that we are engaged with our physical body in the conditions of warmth, but with our etheric body in the conditions of light. However, what we perceive with our etheric body is confused with what we perceive with our physical body. This confusion has been a malady for the modern study of physics since the 16th century. And because of it, everything has gradually been blurred, especially since physics gradually came under the Newtonian influence, which is still effective today. We have forgotten how to express factual situations directly. Individual people have, of course, attempted to refer to the unmediated facts. Goethe on a large scale, and people like Kirchhoff, for example, in a more theoretical way. However, on the whole, we have actually forgotten how to direct our attention purely to the facts. Thus, for example, we have interpreted, in the spirit of Newton, the fact that material bodies near other material bodies fall toward them under certain conditions. We have ascribed this to a force that emanates from one body and is exerted on the other one, gravity. You can cogitate all you want, but you will never be able to count what we understand by the word gravity among the facts. When a stone falls to the earth, then the fact of the matter is merely that it approaches the earth. You see it at one location, then at a second location, at a third location, and so on. If you say that the earth attracts the stone, you are thinking up something besides the facts of the situation. You are no longer purely expressing the phenomenon. We have grown more and more unaccustomed to expressing the phenomenon purely, yet that is what is important. Because if we don't express the phenomena purely, but proceed to made-up explanations, then we can find all kinds of made-up explanations, which often explain the same thing. Assume you have two planetary bodies. You could say that these two bodies attract each other mutually. They send some unknown, like a force, out into space and attract each other. See figure 6C. However, you don't need to say that these bodies mutually attract each other. You can also say that one body is here, the other body is here, and here are also many other little tiny bodies, little ether particles even, if you like, in between. See figure 6D. These little ether particles are in motion and bombard both planetary bodies. Here they're bombarding this way, there they're bombarding that way, and the ones in between are flying back and forth and bombarding too. Now the area of attack here is larger than the one inside there. For that reason, there is less bombarding inside. The result is that the planetary bodies approach each other. They are pushed against each other because of the difference between the number of impacts here in between and the number of impacts made outside. There have been people who have explained gravity by saying that a force acting at a distance attracts the bodies. And there have been people who said that's nonsense, that it is unthinkable to assume that a force acts at a distance. They therefore assume that space is filled up by the ether and add in this bombardment so that the masses will be whisked into each other. Besides these two explanations, there are all sorts of others. This is just a classic example of how we don't look at the real phenomenon, but invent all kinds of explanations. But what is the real reason for this? This inventing of all kinds of unknown agencies, illusory forms of energy which do all sorts of things, that spares us something. Of course, this theorizing about impacts was just as much an invention as the theorizing about long-distance forces. But this invention relieves us of an assumption that is frightfully uncomfortable for people today. For you see, it is always the case that we have to wonder if there are two mutually independent planetary bodies approaching each other, and they show it is in their nature to approach each other, then, of course, there has to be a basic principle causing their approach. There has to be a reason for their approach. It is simpler to make up forces than to say that there is yet another way, namely thinking that the planetary bodies are not independent of each other. If, for example, I lay my hand on my forehead, it won't occur to me to say, my forehead attracts my hand. Instead, I will say, that is an inner act carried out by something that has its basis in the soul and spirit. My hand is simply not independent of my forehead. They are not actually two things, the hand and the forehead. I will only succeed in looking at the situation correctly if I regard myself as a whole. I'm not actually looking at reality if I say, there's a head, there are two arms with hands on them, there's a torso, there are two legs. That's not a complete explanation. Rather, it's a complete examination if I describe the entire unified organism. If I describe the things in such a way that they belong together. That is to say, my task is not merely to describe what I see, but to think about the reality of what I see. Just because I see something doesn't yet mean it is real. Take a cube of rock salt. In a certain sense, it is a whole. Everything is a whole in a certain sense. It can exist by means of the complex of what is within its six sides. If, however, you look at a rose you have cut, this rose is not a whole because it can't exist by means of the complex of what is in it. The rose can exist only because it's on the rose bush. For that reason, the cut rose, although you perceive it just as well as the cube of rock salt, is a true abstraction. It's something that may not be addressed as a reality on its own at all. Something extraordinarily important follows from this. It follows that when confronted with each phenomenon, we have to investigate to what extent it is a reality, or only something that has been cut out of a whole. If you look at the sun and the moon or the sun and the earth on their own, naturally you might as well make up a force of gravity, a kind of gravitation, just as you might invent a kind of gravitation when my forehead attracts my right hand. But when you look at the sun and the earth and the moon, you're looking at things that aren't whole. Rather, they are limbs of the entire planetary system. This is the most important thing, that we observe to what degree something is a whole or is cut out of a whole. Innumerable mistaken notions arise because we regard something that is only a partial phenomenon as a whole. However, you see, by looking at partial phenomena and making up forms of energy, we have spared ourselves the trouble of looking at the life of the planetary system. In other words, we have attempted to treat as a whole that which in nature is only a part, and then to explain by theories all the effects that emerge. To sum up, in everything that we encounter in nature, it's important to ask, what is the whole it belongs to? Or is itself a whole? Or is it itself a whole? In the end, we will find whole things only in a certain respect, for even a cube of rock salt is a whole only in a certain respect. Even such a cube can't exist unless there is a certain temperature or other conditions. Actually, in every instance, it is necessary for us not to look at nature in such a fragmented way as is so commonly done. So, you see, only because we look at nature in such a fragmented way have we gotten into the situation of creating that peculiar figment called universal, inorganic, inanimate nature. An inorganic, inanimate nature doesn't exist, any more than your skeletal system exists without, say, your circulatory system. Just as the skeletal system only crystallizes out of your entire organism, so-called inorganic nature doesn't exist without all of underlying nature, without soul and spirit nature. This lifeless nature is the dismembered skeletal system of all of nature, and it is impossible to look at inorganic nature by itself the way we have been looking at it in Newtonian physics since the 16th century. Nevertheless, the Newtonian approach to physics set out to strip everything down to pure inorganic nature. But inorganic nature is present only when we ourselves build machines, when we ourselves put something together from the parts of nature. However, that is radically different from the way the so-called inorganic itself exists in nature. The only really inorganic things are our machines, and these, in fact, only to the extent that we put them together with combinations of natural forces. It's only the condition of being put together that makes them inorganic. Other kinds of inorganic things are only abstractions. Modern physics arose on the basis of this abstraction. It is nothing more than an abstraction that takes for reality what it has abstracted, and then tries to explain everything it encounters according to its theoretical assumptions. In reality, you see, we actually can't help but form our conceptions, our ideas, with what we are given externally in the world of perception. Now, one phenomenological field has provided us, if I may say so, with an extremely convenient fact. If you strike a bell, and near to it you place some device that is light and easily moved, you can demonstrate that parts of this ringing bell are also vibrating. If you take a reed pipe, you can demonstrate that the air inside the pipe is vibrating. And on the basis of the movement of the air or of the bell particles, you can notice a connection in terms of the pitch or sound phenomena between the vibrations a body or the air makes and the perception of the tone. In this phenomenological field, it's evident that when we hear tones, we are dealing with vibrations in the surrounding air. Thus, there is a connection, which we will talk about further tomorrow, between sounds and vibrations of the air. If you are going to proceed abstractly, you can say that we perceive sound by means of the organs of hearing, the vibrations of the air striking the hearing organ, and when they do, we perceive the sound. Then, since the eye is naturally also a sense organ, you can perceive colors with the eye and say that it must be a similar situation. Thus, some kind of vibration has to strike the eye. However, it can't be the air, that is quickly ascertained, so it's the ether.
Thus we construct the idea, if I may say so, purely by playing with analogies. If air strikes our ears and we sense a sound, there is a connection between vibrating air and the sensation of sound. If the vibrations of the hypothetical ether collide with our eyes, then in a similar way a sensation of light is conveyed. Then we attempt to determine how this so-called ether vibrates through tests like those we have become acquainted with experimentally in these lectures. In other words, we examine an ether ocean and calculate how things are supposed to happen in it. We calculate something that refers to an entity that we are, of course, unable to perceive, which we are only able to assume theoretically. As you've already gathered from the trifles we have gone through experimentally, what takes place within the world of light is extraordinarily complicated, and up through certain periods of the more recent development of physics, it has been assumed that a vibrating ether, a fine elastic substance, lies behind, or actually in, everything that manifests itself as the world of light, as the world of colors. Since we are easily able to determine the laws according to which elastic bodies collide and repel each other, we can calculate what these little goblins in the ether do simply by regarding them as little elastic bodies, by imagining the ether as something that in itself is elastic, so to speak. In this way, we can arrive at explanations of the phenomena that we demonstrated here when we created a spectrum. Various kinds of ether vibrations are separated from each other, which then appear to us as the various colors. By certain calculations, we can also manage to make comprehensible, based on the elasticity of the ether, that cancelling out of the colors, for example, of the sodium line that we demonstrated here the day before yesterday. In addition to these phenomena, others have come up in recent times. We can devise a light spectrum and extinguish or produce the sodium line in it, whichever you want, and produce the black line. Then, besides producing this whole complex, we can also cause an electromagnet to act upon the beam of light in a certain way, and behold, the electromagnet has an effect on the light phenomenon. For example, the sodium line is cancelled at its place and two others appear, purely due to the effect of electricity, which is always associated with magnetic effects in some way. Thus, something that is described to us as electrical forces has an effect on events that we regard as light phenomena, behind which we imagine nothing more than the elastic ether. The fact that we have observed the effect of electricity on this light phenomenon has now led us to assume a relationship between light and electromagnetic phenomena. Thus, things have been shaken up a bit in recent times. Before, we could rest on our laurels because we hadn't yet perceived this interaction. Now, however, we have to say to ourselves that they must have something to do with each other. Currently, this has led many physicists to see an electromagnetic effect in the transmission of light, that what is passing through space actually consists of electromagnetic waves. Now think about what has happened here. What has happened is the following. Earlier, we assumed that we knew what was behind light phenomena, vibrations, undulations in the elastic ether. Now, because we have become acquainted with the interactions between light and electricity, we've come to the point where we have to look at what actually vibrates as electricity, as radiant electricity. Please think about this matter carefully. We want to explain light and color. We trace them back to the vibrating ether. There is something passing through space. Then we believe that we know what light actually is, vibrations of the elastic ether. But now it has become necessary to say that these vibrations of the elastic ether are electromagnetic currents. Now we know what light is even more precisely than before, It consists of electromagnetic currents, only we don't know what these currents are. Thus we have taken the wonderful path of assuming an hypothesis, of explaining the sensible by means of the supersensible unknown of the undulating ether. Gradually, we have been forced once again to trace the supersensible back to the sensible, confessing, at the same time, however, that we don't know now what the latter is. It is indeed a most interesting path that we have traveled, from a hypothetical search for an unknown to the explanation of that unknown by means of another unknown. The physicist Kirchhoff was appalled enough to say that if these more recent phenomena make it necessary not to believe in the ether with its vibrations, then that is no advantage for physics. And Helmholtz, for example, when he became acquainted with these phenomena, said, "Fine, we are not going to get around regarding light as a kind of electromagnetic radiation. Then we're just going to have to trace it back to vibrations of the elastic ether again." The essential point is that we have transposed an honest-to-God wave phenomenon, vibrations of the air when we perceive sounds, by way of pure analogy, into a field where the whole assumption is simply a completely hypothetical one. I had to give you this explanation of principles so that we can swiftly go through the most important questions presented by the phenomena that we still want to look at. In the time that remains to us after having laid this foundation, I intend to discuss sound, temperature, and electromagnetic phenomena, and also how these phenomena reflect on optical phenomena. The end of Lecture 6.